Hey, it's Bobby Bones. If you're a veteran or if you've got a family member or friend who served, I want to tell you about Safeguard Veterans. Sometimes the hardest part isn't asking for help, it's knowing where to turn. Safeguard Veterans connects veterans, families, and caregivers with local support and resources that understand military life. And when you're talking to people who understand those experiences, finding the right support can feel a whole lot easier. Visit safeguardveterans.net and click on your city. Safeguard Veterans, any door. The right support.
You're listening to Off Limits, liberal, irreverent, oh, and really, really gay.
So, hello everybody. Thanks for joining me tonight here on Off Limits Show. We are talking tonight about racial inequity. We're going to talk about several things tonight. I've got several things that I want to discuss about this, and I want to hear from all of you tonight on the show as well. So I hope that you will call in during the show and let me know what your thoughts are on what we're discussing tonight. You can call in using Skype for free by using the Off Limits Show name, or you can call in using 214-377-0481 if you want to dial from your phone. Either way is fine, and I'm happy to certainly happy to hear you and hear what you have to say about everything. Hopefully, let's see here. Wait a second. Apparently, I've got something fucked up as usual on here. I'm hearing myself somewhere, and I don't know where I'm hearing myself from besides what I'm saying right now on the show. Let's see. There we go. Okay. Anyway, so if you want to call in, once again, the number is 214-377-0481. I'll take calls in about 10, 15 minutes into the show. But I certainly have a lot to say before that about this topic, and I'm sure all of you do as well. And, of course, it's a very volatile topic. A lot of people have issues discussing this. But I'm not really sure why, but it seems like race in America, you know, is always a really touchy topic. And when it comes to discussing racial inequity in America, that is even more so sometimes, because some people will say, or a lot of people will say, well, minorities just need to get over it. You know, this is not the slave days anymore, or we have laws passed now, they'll say, or it's not that way here anymore. But typically people who say this are themselves Caucasian or some group that's not oppressed racially. So it's easy for, of course, for them to say that. It's easy for them to say these things when they are not someone who's subjected to it on a daily basis. And it does affect everybody's life. It doesn't just affect you know, anyone who is subjected to oppression is without a doubt affected by it. Their lives are affected by it. And to say that they're not is just plain ignorant. Hold on. And so I think that it's very important that people realize that when people are talking about these issues, they're talking about them because they are things that affect their lives every single day, not something that just they can sometimes do and sometimes not do, or they can sometimes not be Black or Hispanic or Asian or otherwise. This is something that, you know, people don't have a choice about. So I hope that people understand the distinction there and understand that, you know, why I want to discuss racial inequity tonight on the show. You know, people have asked or have said even, you know, people have asked a lot the question, do we now live in a post-racial society in America? And what we're going to talk about tonight will prove that no, we do not live in a post-racial society. Race is still today one of, if not the most divisive subjects among humanity, not just in America, but throughout the world. And it's unfortunately something that, as I just mentioned, people see completely differently. You know, if you ask one person about race and they're like, oh, it's not a problem anymore, and someone else it is. So I hope that tonight we can have a discussion about it, and you guys will call in when I start to take calls in a few minutes, and we can actually, you know, get your ideas and your impressions of what's happening in your life if you're a racial minority yourself, or if you're not, and how it affects you, and how things actually are. Oh, hey, by the way, hey, David, hey, Ken, thanks for joining me tonight there in the chat. And so hopefully we can discuss this from a very positive perspective. And this is the first show, the first Off Limits show I've had on Spreaker. I have Off Limits show all the time, but I have sort of different incarnations. You know, I have the Brain Purge show, I have the other shows, whatever, Game Ass, whatever. But this is the first Off Limits show I've had where I actually talk about a serious topic, and it's really all about that. And so hopefully it will go better on this network than it did on other ones. Like, callers that I get aren't going to be all trolls, hopefully. So hopefully you'll call in. By the way, if you do call in during the show, and if you're listening now, and I'll say the magic secret word, two or three times throughout the show, and when I begin to take calls, the first caller who knows this with the word and wants a free t-shirt will get a free t-shirt sent to them if they want, whichever one you choose. I've got a couple in the shop if you're interested on offlimitsshow.com, which, by the way, you can hear the show live from there as well as chat there live, and also on spreaker.com. I'm also on Facebook and Twitter and stitcher.com. So I'm all over the place. By the way, the secret word is egalitarianism. So if you say egalitarianism to me and you're the first caller when I start to take calls, then you will win a free t-shirt. Free! Whatever size you need. Whatever size you need, David. So, you know, no problem. Anyway, so that's what we're talking about tonight. Now, interestingly enough, yesterday we were celebrating 50 years since the I Have a Dream speech and the March on Washington. That, you know, 50 years later, how far have we come with racial equality in this country? How far have we come? Is it better today than it was during MLK's speech? Is it significantly better? Do people have equal opportunity in every respect? Are people looked at in the same way, whether you're white or Black or Hispanic or Asian, no matter who's doing the looking? Is racial equality real today in 2013, 50 years later? So that's the question I'm wanting to know. So I'm going to play real quick. It's 5 minutes long. It's the MLK I Have a Dream speech. And I want to, before we start talking about what we're talking about, I want to play that in honor of the 50 years anniversary of his March on Washington. And I also want to kind of lead from that into what we're talking about tonight. So 5 minutes, we'll be right back.
Thank you. freedom ring, and if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring from the prodigious hilltops of New Hampshire. Let freedom ring from the mighty mountains of New York. Let freedom ring from the heightening Alleghenies of Pennsylvania. Let freedom ring from the snow-capped Rockies of Colorado. Let freedom ring from the curvaceous slopes of California. But not only that, let freedom ring from Stone Mountain of Georgia. Let freedom ring from Lookout Mountain of Tennessee. Let freedom ring from every hill and molehill of Mississippi, from every mountainside. Let freedom ring, and when this happens, and when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
Okay, hello. Hello, everybody. Sorry about that. So, sorry, what I had done, I wish somebody had told me that I had actually not, you couldn't hear anything. For God's sakes, I was playing it for 4 minutes. Nobody said anything. Anyway, I forgot to turn the, to push a button. Sorry, that was my fault. Sorry about that. And anyway, sorry about that, everybody. Hold on a second. Okay. So, anyway, you get the picture. You've heard the speech before anyway, so I apologize for it not working, but you get the picture. Next time, if you can't hear me speaking, please say something, because if you're there in the chat room, I don't know. I need to look at the levels when I'm doing it. I forgot to look at the level to see that there was no sound coming out. So apologize. I apologize. Anyway, so this is the 50th anniversary of that. You know, I'll judge you by the content of your character, blah, blah, blah. You know the speech, but anywho, the question is, have we come farther now 50 years later than we were in that era? And the question becomes, and the proof of whether we have actually advanced, meaning we being a society and people who are minorities or whatever have advanced in this country, the way you decipher or determine whether there's been true advancement since that time is through income, employment, and social and the justice system. These are the true telltale signs of whether society has changed or not for the better in relation to race relations. So the question is, are we better off now than we were then? And so we're going to look at this from four different standpoints. As I said, income, employment, social views, and then the justice system. So we're first going to look at it from an income level and income disparity, and that's going to determine whether we're going to use these criteria to determine whether there is racial inequity today. So when it comes to income levels, for example, okay, a lot of the demands, you know, that were made at the 1963 March on Washington led to a lot of gains for blacks in this country. And not just for blacks, it didn't just benefit from it, but also ultimately Hispanics, Asians, etc., other minorities, racial minorities. But with respect to the wealth of, you know, the area that really impacts economic mobility the most is wealth, African Americans really are not doing that well. There's a huge divide in wealth, which is defined basically by a household's debt subtracted from a household's owned assets. So that gap has widened substantially over the past few decades. And the question is why, which we're going to address. And a lot of racists will say one thing, and people who are actually paying attention to the facts will and realize it's much more complicated than that, we'll look at another. But middle and high income blacks, basically, basically middle class and affluent blacks in America, saw the levels of wealth, of their wealth, stagnate or go down over the past few decades, while middle class and affluent whites, their wealth has increased. And during this recession we've had, African Americans lost more of their assets disproportionately to whites than, and now only have 5% of the wealth that whites had. So basically, to look at that in a number sense, 2010, blacks' wealth was, white wealth, median household wealth by race for whites was $97,000. That's the median household income level for whites in America in 2010. $97,000. For blacks, it was $4,890. That really helps to illustrate the huge disparity between black and white wealth in this country. There's an enormous disparity. Those are median income levels, obviously. But so the average white person has $97,000 in income level or household wealth, whereas the average black has $4,800 now in 2010 anyway. And so and the thing about this is, and why wealth is such something we should talk about when examining whether there is racial inequity in this country still, is wealth is basically the primary force of inequality. Over the past 50 years, there's been decades and decades and decades of direct discrimination and segregation that have limited African Americans' ability to accumulate wealth, to transfer to their families at a rate that's comparable to white Americans. So do you see what I'm saying? So basically, for example, because of the discrimination that has happened, for decades and decades and even hundreds of years before, and segregation and everything else happened before African-Americans got quote-unquote civil rights in this country, all of those years, all of that time, those hundreds of years put African-Americans at a huge disadvantage in terms of catching up to where white people were in terms of their wealth, because white people, all of those hundreds of years in America, were able to pass down their wealth to one generation, to the next, to the next, to the next, to the next. And so every generation, if they were lucky, it would grow. And every generation had more opportunities as a result of inheriting this wealth, because they were able to start businesses or buy property, real estate, whatever, run for government, whatever the case was, or go to college, obviously, and educate themselves. Whereas the blacks in America had to wait 250 plus years before they were able to even begin to get to the same level of income as anyone else. And so it's just now that you're seeing people in this country who actually are achieving great wealth who are black, okay? It's just now, and that's only a very, very small percentage. But low wealth also means basically opportunities like stock ownership, home equity and pension coverages and things like that. They're less accessible to African Americans compared to white Americans. And this makes it a lot more difficult for blacks to build assets and mobility, to move themselves up in society when because they haven't got the wealth to purchase these things like stock and home equity and education, etc. They can't move up in society because that's how you move up here. And so there was a study, and the study says it will take 634 years to reach black-white wealth equality in the United States. Okay? So in the United States, that's what we're talking about. By the way, Guy Shea, whatever your fucking name is, we're going to address the justice system and drugs, and I'm going to talk about everything that you're trying to say, which is all bullshit, by the way, later in the show. So if you want to keep listening, great. If you don't, that's fine. But I'm going to address everything you're talking about because it's all fucking bullshit. All right. So, and the last thing I want to say is that 85%, when it comes to people in terms of income equality in this country, and blacks and whites or Hispanics or whatever, or Asians, whatever, more specifically blacks and Hispanics, 85% of whites in this country live in communities that have no black or Hispanic homeowners or people in their community at all. 85%. So that means 15% of this country, only 15% of this country is actually integrated in terms of where they live and how they live, et cetera, and they socialize with one another, blah, blah, blah. 85% of whites in this country live in communities without blacks or Hispanics. And so the answer to the question in terms of income equality is no, there is not income equality. And I want to play a short clip. It's only like 3 minutes long. This really helps illustrate perfectly the what I'm saying here. I hope if I can find it. Let's see here. Where is it? Da-da-da. I think this is it. Fuck, I think I lost it. Oh, wait a second. Hold on. Tracking. Here it is. Okay, I found it. So I'm going to play this real quick. It's only 2 minutes long, actually. But listen to what this guy is saying. And he's going to perfectly illustrate. He's a Caucasian man, by the way. He's going to perfectly tell you why they're beyond everything I just mentioned, but also illustrate what I just said to you, why we still have income inequality here and why we still have inequality, generally speaking, in this country for African-Americans and specifically African-Americans, but also other minorities. Okay, so listen to this real quick. 2 minutes long.
A piece, I think it was in the New York Times, right after or right before the election, where he said that, you know, basically racism is not a problem anymore because when white folks get to know black folks, well, their biases and their fears subside. Now, number one, I'm not sure that's true. But secondly, even if it were true, the truth is, given the history of racism, spatial segregation, residential isolation, the fact that 85% of white folks live in communities with virtually no people of color around, even if he were right, it wouldn't matter because most white folks won't get that opportunity to actually form close, intimate friendships or connections with people of color. And unfortunately, if it isn't happening, the only way we get to know folks of color is via media. So maybe we see Barack Obama on television coming into our living rooms every night. And over an 18-month to 2-year period, we're able to say, yeah, you know, I sort of like that guy. He seems really capable and really bright. Maybe I wasn't sure at first, but given 2 years, he was able to overcome, you know, maybe my first impression. But the only other folks we're seeing in the media are either folks who are sort of superstars on the one hand, or criminals on the other hand. Those are the black folks we typically see on TV. They're either like mega millionaire athletes or entertainers, or they're the folks doing a perp walk on the 6 o'clock news that the cops have just gone arrested and haven't even let them put a shirt on before cuffing them and bringing them out in front of the cameras. If the only people you see regularly are superstar millionaires and thugs, for the average person, they can't relate to either of those, right? The average person of color can't, and the average white person can't either. The superstar, you're likely to envy their position, and the thug you're afraid of. And envy and fear are not particularly good human emotions upon which to base some personal connections or intimate relationships. So I think that's what we're dealing with. You know, Barack Obama or Bill Cosby or Oprah Winfrey or a handful of people of color, we're able to get to know them, or at least we think we know them, via media. But for average everyday white folks and for average everyday black and brown folks, the ability to really get to know each other and overcome.
So anyway, what he's saying, obviously, is the examples of what there's going to be silence after I play a song because of the board I'm using. I can't use Spreaker's switchboard or whatever player and still take calls. I have to use a different ones. And whenever I come back from a song or anything, there will be about a 30-second delay before you hear me. So I apologize. But anyway, what the guy is saying is, if you were listening to that clip, is this, is that what do Americans see when it comes to African-Americans in this country? Who do they see? What are the representations of African-Americans? They're either superstars who are making billions and millions of dollars a year, Oprah Winfrey, Michael Jordan, whomever, there's tons of them, Beyonce, up there, who are shining examples of of wealth, of major wealth in this country, and don't necessarily have the same types of issues that someone else in the middle class would have. Then they also see, so they see the high echelon, the upper high class, wealthy black people, and then they see the people who are on TV getting arrested, and the people who are drug dealers and druggies, etc. Those are the two that they see. So they see the people on TV, and that's pretty much their entire understanding of black people, generally speaking. Now, what about the people in the middle, which is the majority of black people in this country, or people of any color in this country? Most people don't see the blacks in this country that are actually everyday hardworking citizens who actually go to work and actually are lawyers or doctors or work at a factory or in a bar or in a restaurant or whatever. They don't see those people unless they know them. And so the people that they have examples of, they have people to fear, and they have people to envy. They fear the blacks that are considered to be thugs, the blacks that are drug dealers or rapists or pimps or whatever they see on the television, and that's what they see in the news. They fear those blacks, and then they envy the other blacks, the blacks that are at the top of the heap, that they'll never be themselves. Most people in this country will never be. So fear and envy, as the guy was saying, neither one of those are positive emotions or positive feelings towards a race. And so if that is the preponderance of what you know about a particular race, fear and envy, and those are the messages that you are continually being shown and that you're continually being bombarded by, then yeah, it's quite likely that you're going to fear and or envy black people, and you're not going to know them or like them as just people just like you. And so this is part of the issue. This is part of the problem. So next up, we're going to talk about employment. And I saw that that David in the chat room was talking about some experiences he had had being with employment or whatever, being fired because of his race, etc., or as a result of it somehow or another. So I haven't seen what he said, but I do want to actually address that employment. And we're going to talk about how you can know when somebody's actually treating you one way or another because of your race, as opposed to for a legitimate reason. First, we're going to talk about employment. Then we're going to talk about social, and then we're going to talk about the justice system and people in jail and civil rights, etc. So I'll be right back after this. If you want to call in to the show, the number is 214-377-0481. You can also use Skype and call into the show for free, calling the Off Limits Show, and I'll take your call when I can. I'll be right back after this.
Your mind. I'm a prostitute. No, no. I like rock music where hip hop grows. That doesn't mean that I'm a sinner. No, no, no.
Testing, testing. Hello. So there we go. So anyway, so we're back. Sorry about that. So we've talked about so far racial inequity through income. And so before I move on with that, I want to say, what is it you do about that? What is it you can do about it? What do you do about the fact that there is a great inequity in income levels in this country? What can you do as a Caucasian person? What can you do as a Black person? You know, that's the question. So I just like to know what is the solution when you actually have a problem like this. And the solution is, when it comes to racial inequity, is that income inequity, is that you can actually solve the issue by ensuring that there are actual equal opportunities for everyone in this country to achieve the same thing in the same way, in the same method, and getting rid of the Voting Rights Act and getting rid of affirmative action. Sorry, I couldn't think of the term of affirmative action or whatever, is not the way to do that. And to say that this country is at a place where those things are no longer needed is ignorant. So I want to address the guy in the chat room. Guy Shea is his name. Guy Shea says, what does he say? He's a guy in the chat room who doesn't like what we're saying here on the show. He says that he is, where is he? He says he's mixed. He doesn't say what he's mixed with. And originally from Sicily. Guess he's half hated, he says. Well, first of all, you shouldn't make assumptions, you know, that I assume you're a horrible person because of your race. The reason I ask you what your race was, which I get asked constantly, by the way, is because if you're someone who's Caucasian and you come into the chat room and you're saying that we should just not worry about race, that it's ridiculous to talk about it in this day and age, it's no longer an issue or whatever else you're saying in there, to say these things, or as if racism doesn't exist at all, or that it's not an important issue to address, if you're going to say that and you're Caucasian, then that means, says to me, that you're someone who doesn't know what the fuck you're talking about, because you have never experienced the type of racism that most people in this country that are minorities, racial minorities, have. And so you're speaking out of turn. You don't know what the fuck you're just talking about. You don't understand what it means to be discriminated against based on how you look, or based on, you know, whether it's in employment or socially or in the justice system or when it comes to your wealth or whatever the case may be. You don't understand that. That's why I wanted to know whether you were Caucasian or not. You still haven't told me, but anyway. And if you're a Black person saying that, then you're just basically a complete idiot to say that the same things I just said that you may have said. So yeah, I absolutely do use the term idiot and ignorant, because, and I am not somebody who, you know, I don't hold back what my thoughts are. And, you know, Ken in there said he wouldn't say idiot. He would say it was just his perspective. Well, no. And the reason why is this. If you are it's your perspective, yes, it can be someone's perspective, but that doesn't mean they're not an idiot for having it. You know, I can say my perspective is that every redheaded person in the world should be shot. Does that mean I'm smart? No, it makes me an idiot to think that, because I think that every redheaded person should be shot because they have red hair or whatever the case may be. Do you see my point? So just because someone has a perspective does not make that perspective okay or acceptable or right. And so, yes, I do use the term idiot because that's what he is, if that's what he believes, in my perspective. And then I also feel that it's essentially just ignorance, anybody who feels the way that he's saying in there. But also what I said in the chat was, he said, it's not that I don't believe that racism doesn't exist. He said, no, I never said no racism, just the opposite. Until we stop splitting race, then we don't move forward. Agreed. And I said, I agreed that there shouldn't be racism, but the fact is there is. To just quote unquote move on is just to ignore an existing problem. So I don't agree with what he's saying at all. And that's part of the problem when you talk about racism in this country or racial inequity or anything, because we have two views, right? And we have people who think that being that race is a solved issue, a solved problem in this country. And I just proved to you that it is not. That is not proven just by the one of the four topics we're talking about tonight. One of the four types of proof we're using to prove that racial inequity does still exist. Income was the first one we discussed a minute ago. So next we're going to talk about employment. Employment's a huge one, obviously. And when it comes to employment in the United States of America, being African American, being Hispanic, being Asian, being Arab, or whatever racial background you are that's not Caucasian is typically seen as a negative, and is typically seen as not something that is considered a positive. And there's factual proof about this too, okay? There's proof by studies by MIT, which is an economics economics professor at MIT did a study about this as well. And I have tons of resources I can tell you about that I got these from. And so whereas most whites who possess a college degree are facing unemployment rates in the 4% range, okay, 4%. And this is now, these are statistics from the past year or so. African-American graduates face 7% unemployment. And this is generally attributed to segregation, which is essentially, what is segregation? And when it comes to employment, it's the practice of locking out African-Americans out of networks, you know, the Good Old Boys Network, for example, or, you know, essentially people just hiring people just like themselves and no one else. A diploma isn't necessarily a pathway to the middle class anymore. And so it really challenges the old adage that, you know, the education is the great equalizer among race, because obviously this is not the case. And in 2003, the professors I mentioned, the economics professors at MIT, found that the applicants, thorough study on people being hired or not hired based upon their races, whether they had white sounding names or black sounding names. Okay. And they found that applicants with quote unquote white sounding names were 50% more likely to receive a callback after submitting a resume than those were with black sounding names. And these people had the exact same resumes or the exact same qualifications. They had no differences other than the way their name sounded. So for example, if you had maybe Tamika Johnson for the black person, and she had the exact same educational background, the exact same experience level, the exact same everything, you know, in terms of skill sets. And then you had someone named Sylvia, I don't know, Janet Smith, okay, or whatever, and she had the exact same as Tamika did. Out of those, half of the ones, the white ones, always got called back twice as much as the black ones, the black sounding names. So it is obvious that it is true that we still have racial disparity in this country when it comes to employment as well. And in terms of the study, they said that whiteness was worth 8 years of work experience relative to applying to a job. And so, which really reveals basically how much of a detriment it is to one's job future if you're not white or don't seem to be white or perceived to be something different. And so race definitely impacts the prospect of being unemployed or even a member of the working class or the middle class. And so in their study, they said that, this is what they said, quote, they said, quote, while one may have expected that improved credentials may alleviate employers' fear that African-American applicants are deficient in some unobservable skills, this is not the case in our data. Discrimination, therefore, appears to be twice, making it harder not only for African-Americans to find a job, but also to improve their employability. And researchers sent out 6,200 resumes to employment agencies, also another one, 6,200 resumes to a temporary employment agencies throughout California, and each applicant possessed the same qualifications. Applicants with Latino and, quote, white-sounding names received callbacks far more frequently than those presumed to be African-American or South Asian Arab-American, who were called back the least frequently. So it is obvious that we still have an issue in this country, and to say we don't is bullshit. To say we don't is to be ignorant of what we have going on in this country. It is absolutely ignorance that would make someone say that it doesn't exist. And so once you get past the point of saying that it doesn't exist and you realize that it does, then what do you do about it? So when it comes to employment, that's why we have non-discrimination acts. That's why we have Equal Opportunity Act, whatever, in this country to protect people from it. And actually, Republicans and some right-wing people are trying to, all Caucasian, by the way, are trying to overturn the Equal Opportunity Act, of all things. And they're also trying to overturn the, what was the other one? I can't remember. What was the other one? I can't remember. But they did overturn the Voting Rights Act, a portion of it, because they said we no longer have a need for this in America because we have a half black president and we no longer have discrimination. Don't you think that the fact or the idea of whether or not we have discrimination in this country should come from minorities and not from the majority rule? Don't you think that the people who actually experience being oppressed, the people who actually experience the sting of discrimination are the ones that should determine when we feel it is no longer an issue in America, not the rest of America. So that's that. All right. So the next thing I'm going to play you, it's a really short clip too. It's a really interesting story. Very good. I want you to listen to it. It's we're going to talk about the social aspect of racism, the social aspect of racial inequality, or inequity in America. We're going to talk about that next. And, it's very, very interesting what this woman says. If you listen to her, it's only like 3 minutes long. She's talking about, well, you'll see what she's talking about, but I want you to listen carefully what she's saying, because I myself, being that I'm biracial, my mother is German, my father is African. My mother is German descent, my father's African descent. And so because of that, I really do understand both sides of the coin. I've been perceived as white in my lifetime. I've been perceived as black in my lifetime. I've been perceived as Hispanic. I've been perceived as Asian even. I've been perceived as everything, I think, under the fucking sun. I've been perceived at one point in my life, depending on how I looked at that point in my lifetime. So I do understand what it means and what it feels like to be most races, because I've been perceived by that by most people. So listen to how white privilege, which is what we're talking about next, really does actually help, can be helpful to people who don't have that in America. So here we go. Listen to this.
Grew up together. My sister-in-law, who's half black, half white, but looks white, blue eyes, whiter than most white folks, very white. She and I, you know, we kind of grew up together. We raised our children together. So they're first cousins, and we've, you know, it's a wonderful, very, very multicultural family. So we're going in a Safeway one day, and Kathleen, my sister-in-law, is in front of me. And she's, you know, writing a check for her groceries. Now, my daughter, who at the time was 10 years old, was standing with me, and I was directly behind her, you know, getting ready to get my groceries. So Kathleen comes up, and the checker, who is a strawberry blonde, freckled, very delightful, warm, you know, the checker, this young woman, is talking to Kathleen. Hey, how you doing? Isn't it a nice day today? They're just chatting up. And she says, yeah. So Kathy writes her check, and she steps off to the side with her groceries because she's waiting for me. Of course, again, Kathleen looks white, right? So I come up. No conversation. She looks up at me. Absolutely no, just little chatter. And I write my check. My daughter, however, is 10, notices immediately the difference in how she responds to me. So I write my check, and she goes, I'm going to need 2 pieces of ID. At which point, my daughter looks at me, and she gets very, very embarrassed, and tears are kind of coming up in her eye, like, Mommy, you're not gonna let her do this. Why is she doing this to us, right? So I'm trying to figure out what I should do, because behind me are 2 elderly white women, right? And I'm thinking, okay, so then I become the angry black woman, right? And they're gonna be, and I'm just trying to second guess all the drama. So then I just give her the 2 pieces of ID. I said, you know, some things you gotta choose your battles, right? And then it gets worse. She pulls out the bad check book, right? So this is the book that shows the people who have written bad checks. So she starts searching for my license in the bad checks, at which point it's just out of control now. Just as I'm standing there trying to decide what to do, and it's really deeply humiliating. Now my daughter is in full-blown emotionally upset, who's 10. My sister-in-law walks back over. And she steps in and she says, excuse me, why are you doing this? And the checker goes, well, what do you mean? She goes, why are you taking her through all of these changes? Why are you doing that? She goes, well, this is our policy. She goes, no, it's not your policy because you didn't do that with me. Oh, well, I know you. You've been. She goes, no, she's been here for years. I've only lived here for 3 months. And so at this point, the two white elderly ladies go, oh, I can't believe what this checker has done with this woman. It is totally unacceptable. At which point, the manager walks over. So the manager walks over and says, is there a problem here? And then my sister-in-law again responds. She goes, yes, there is a problem here. Here is what happened. So you see, she used her white privilege. And even though Kathleen is half black and half white, she recognizes what that means. And she made the statement. She pointed out the injustice. And she, as a result of that one act, influenced everyone in that space. But what would have happened? I can't know for certain had the black woman said, this is unfair. Why are you doing this to me? Would it have had the same impact? But Kathleen knew that she walked through the world differently than I did. And she used her white privilege to educate and make right a situation.
Testing. Okay, there we go. Sorry about that. Anyway, so you see this example of this woman who is perceived as being Caucasian, although she's half black and half white, and her sister comes up right behind her. Her sister's treated one way and she's treated another. And the woman had no idea they were related, thought they were complete strangers, I guess, or whatever. Even if she did know they were related, she didn't think they were the same. And she treated them quite differently. So this just illustrates that there obviously are people that are treated differently just because of their race. I mean, I think everybody, whatever race you are, if you're a minority race in this country, then you understand what it means to be shopping while black or shopping while Mexican or shopping whatever the case may be. You know what I mean? And so people follow you around because you look a certain way, whether you're dressed in a fucking suit or you're dressed in low hung jeans off your fucking ass. Whatever the case is, it doesn't matter. If you have a certain color of skin, they will follow you around and perceive you as being different and being untrustworthy. So it is obvious in social situations and circles that it is obvious that there is racial inequity there as well. And I think, you know, a lot of people forget that. And that's the other thing I want to say is that people are often like, well, what is the big deal? You know, race, talking about race, blah, 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 whatever. Like, it's not supposed to be talked about or we shouldn't discuss it. Well, the reality is that if it's not discussed, it will never change. Not talking about race would mean that we're accepting it as okay, that the racial bias in this country is acceptable to the rest of us, and it's not acceptable. And to not discuss it and not to say that it exists is not only ignorant, but it's also to say that I am okay with it, and I'm not okay with it, and most people are not okay with it, whether you're white or black or whatever race you are. And there are plenty of Caucasian people in this country, in this world, who are not racist at all and have no racial bias really in their makeup. And there are plenty who do. There are plenty of racists who are black. There are plenty of racists who are Mexican. There are plenty of racists who are Asian. The racists come in every color, shape, size, you know. It's not just white people against black people, but this just illustrates the most disparity, I think, between the races, because when it comes to black people and white people, in terms of income, in terms of equality and in employment, and also in social circles, it is something that is a drawback. And also, I read a story that there was a black fraternity on a campus where it's predominantly Caucasian. And on that campus, they actually were, it was during rush week or whatever. And so a lot of the white guys in the fraternities on the same block would actually come together and congregate outside of their fraternity house. And they would be talking in morality and whatever. Nothing happened. Nobody came by, nothing. However, when it was a group of black men, 15 black men or so, who were congregating outside the front of their fraternity house, the cops came down. The cops came down and stood there and watched them, okay? And just stood there, didn't say anything to them, just stood there and watched them. And whenever they would come out, that's what they would do. But whenever it was the white kids, they didn't do shit. So, I mean, how many more ways do I have to illustrate that there is obviously racial inequity in this country? Come on, people, come on. Oh, that's funny. funny. That's funny. Funny guy. Anyway, so last thing I want to say, and last point to illustrate is the justice system here in the country. And I wanted to talk about that and express to you why there is racial inequality in the justice system. And if I can find the one last clip I'm going to play, and then we can move on to that, we'll be done. Where is the cracking? Is that it right there? Crap. I don't know if this is it or not. Let me see. I've got all these clips on here, and I'm trying to find... Oh, here it is. This is it. Okay, so listen to this. It's a two-minute clip, and then we'll talk about the about racial inequality in the justice system. Be right back.
War on drugs routinely targets people of color, often living in ghetto areas, for stops and searches, you know, typically in a futile effort to find drugs. The problem that we face as civil rights lawyers and advocates is that it's extremely difficult to prove race discrimination because the Supreme Court, you know, has required that you offer evidence of conscious racial bias, some kind of admission, in order to even get in the courthouse door. So that's why we don't see so many cases involving, you know, racial bias in the criminal justice system. The single most important thing we can do to eliminate racial bias in the criminal justice system today is to end the war on drugs. The drug war is responsible for the arrest, incarceration, and branding of millions of people of color as felons, relegating them to a permanent second-class status for life. Drug use, abuse, as well as drug dealing is just as prevalent in white communities as it is in poor communities of color, but the drug war has been waged almost exclusively in ghetto communities, resulting in what I believe is a racial undercast. An enormous population of black and brown folks who are poor, who have been labeled felons for engaging in precisely the same kind of behavior, illegal drug activity.
Hello. Okay, hello. There we go. I'm back again. Sorry. So as you can see, you know, it's very true that there's inequality when it comes to the justice system. You know, she was saying that there are communities that are targeted and that the drug war is just as prevalent in the Caucasian or white, quote unquote, white communities as it is in the poorer communities or even the black communities or Hispanic communities. Yet it is the black and Hispanic communities that are targeted primarily for or by law enforcement. And I'm sure that, just as she said, but I'm sure that that is something that is prevalent all over the country. It is obvious that race is an issue. So I want to talk about the justice system real quick, tell you the 10 facts pertaining to the criminal justice system that impact on communities of color, and then we're going to wrap it up. So here we go. Unless somebody wants to call in, for God's sakes. That's why I'm having this fucking show this way. Anyway, so first of all, while people of color make up 30% of the United States population, they account for 60% of those that are imprisoned. The prison population grew by 700% from 1970 to 2005, a rate that is outpacing crime and population rates. The incarceration rates disproportionately impact men of color. One in every 15 African-American men and one in every 36 Hispanic men are incarcerated in comparison to one in every 106 white men. So for every one of every 15 African American men are incarcerated. That's a fucking lot. One out of every 36 Hispanic men are incarcerated, and one out of every 106 white men are incarcerated. So that's a really startling statistic. Number two of 10, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, one in three black men can expect to go to prison in their lifetime. Individuals of color have a disproportionate number of encounters with law enforcement, indicating that racial profiling continues to be a problem. A report by the Department of Justice found that blacks and Hispanics were approximately three times more likely to be searched during a traffic stop than white motorists. African Americans were twice as likely to be arrested and almost four times as likely to experience the use of force during encounters with the police. Number three, students of color face harsher punishments in school than their white peers, leading to a higher number of youth of color incarcerated. Black and Hispanic students represent more than 70% of those involved in school-related arrests or referrals to law enforcement. Currently, African Americans make up 2/5 and Hispanics 1/5 of confined youth today. Number four, according to recent data by the Department of Education, African American students are arrested far more than their white classmates. The data showed that 96,000 students were arrested and 242,000 referred to law enforcement by schools during the 2009 to 2010 school year. Of those students, black and Hispanic students made up more than 70% of arrested or referred students. Harsh school punishments, from suspensions to arrests, have led to high numbers of youth of color coming into contact with the juvenile justice system at an earlier age. Number five of 10, African American youth have a higher rate of juvenile incarceration and are more likely to be sentenced to adult prison. According to the Sentencing Project, even though African American juvenile youth are about 16% of the youth population, 37% of their cases are moved to criminal court, and 58% of African American youth are sent to adult prisons. That's horrible. Number six of 10, as the number of women incarcerated has increased by 800% over the last three decades, women of color have been disproportionately represented. While the number of women incarcerated is relatively low, the racial and ethnic disparities are startling. African American women are three times more likely than white women to be incarcerated, while Hispanic women are 69% more likely than white women to be incarcerated. Number seven, the war on drugs has been waged primarily in communities of color, where people of color are more likely to receive higher offenses. According to the Human Rights Watch, people of color are no more likely to use or sell illegal drugs than whites, but they have higher rates of arrests. African Americans comprise 14% of regular drug users, but are 37% of those arrested for drug offenses. From 1980 to 2007, about one in three of the 25.4 million adults arrested for drugs were African American. Number eight of 10, just three more people. Once convicted, black offenders receive longer sentences compared to white offenders. The U.S. Sentencing Commission stated that in the federal system, black offenders receive sentences that are 10% longer than white offenders for the same crimes. The Sentencing Project reports that African Americans are 21% more likely to receive mandatory minimum sentences than white defendants and are 20% more likely to be sentenced to prison. Number nine, voter laws that prohibit people with felony convictions to vote disproportionately impact men of color. An estimated 5.3 million Americans are denied the right to vote based on past felony conviction. Felony disenfranchisement is exaggerated by racial disparities in this criminal justice system, ultimately denying 13% of African American men the right to vote. Felony disenfranchisement policies have led to 11 states denying the right to vote to more than 10% of their African-American population. And then the last one is, number 10, says studies have shown that people of color face disparities in wage trajectory following release from prison. Evidence shows that spending time in prison affects wage trajectories with a disproportionate impact on black men and women. The results show no evidence of racial divergence in wages prior to incarceration. However, following release from prison, wages grow at a 21% slower rate for black former inmates compared to white ex-convicts. A number of states have bans on people with certain convictions working in domestic health service industries such as nursing, child care, and home health care, areas in which many poor women and women of color are disproportionately concentrated. So, that was a lot of facts. Sorry, but I had to read all of those because I wanted to illustrate to you how completely lopsided and how completely how much inequity there is with when it comes to race in the justice system for people of color, whether you're black, Hispanic, whatever. And it is unfortunate that people think that, you know, because of these statistics, because people are using race to determine someone's worth or someone's value or whether someone's going to be a reoffender or whatever. They're using race, whether they say that's what they're doing or not, but it's obvious by these statistics that's what they're doing. You're disproportionately harming black people or Hispanic people far more than you're harming Caucasians. So it's obvious that there's racism still prevalent today when it comes to our justice system. Oh, we've got a caller. Let's see what they have to say. Make sure I've got this set up right here. You're on the Off Limits Show. Hello.
Hello.
Hi. How are you?
Hi. I'm good. How are you?
Good. What's your name?
I'm Ken Bongle.
How's it going, Ken?
It's good. How's it? I hear you talking, but oh, there you are. I'm on a delay. So sorry.
Yeah.
I sound like an idiot. Okay. So the reason I waited so long to call in is because my thing is that I'm not racist, and my thing is that I don't see racial inequality because A, I am white,
mm-hmm.
and also because it's just not something that I see. It's not something that I experience in my town. People
right.
of color are all around me, and we're all treated equally in my perspective. And yeah, it's lopsided as I am Caucasian, but I think that a lot of people, especially in my age range, they don't see racial inequality the way that others see it. The people who are older than us and people who are, do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like...
Well, what's your age range?
Well, I'm 30.
Okay, you're 30. Okay.
30, yeah. Right. So, I mean, but to me, I don't really see it.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to move beyond it because I understand that there really is no basis for it.
Where do you live?
You know what I mean? Like, well, I live in Kentucky.
Okay. And so in your Kentucky town, are you living in a large town or small town?
I'm somewhere in the middle.
Somewhere in the middle.
Second largest city in the state, yeah.
Okay. So in your town, how many would you say percentage-wise of your town is black or Hispanic? Just generally, just off the top of your head.
I would say something to the effect of probably the Caucasian, like, solely Caucasian, purely Caucasian is a minority in my town.
Okay. Well, that's one reason you probably don't see a huge issue because...
Yeah, I don't.
It's more diverse. No. Your town is very diverse, and so the ruling, quote-unquote, ruling race, if you want to put it that way, is not one or the other. It seems like it's pretty evenly spread it's pretty easily spread out among the races there, it seems. So that's probably one reason you don't see it so much. But I'm sure, have you ever left Kentucky or not?
Oh, yeah. Well, I've been all over the world. But
okay.
It's like I spent some time in the Middle East, and then I've been all over the country. But what is it? 5x5 says, unless you live in Louisville or Lexington, it can be rough. That's totally true. But there's so much hatred in the world. As long as people feel the desire to be better than someone else, there will always be inequality.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There will always be inequality. And it's a socioeconomic and a geographical thing, I believe, because, you know, the further south you get, the worse it tends to become. But those people hate everybody.
Well,
The
thing is that like you yourself said when you first called, is it's that just because you don't see it, because you haven't experienced it yourself, because you haven't really had a reason to experience, you yourself are not a racial minority, and you're in a town where you have quite apparently abundant amount of diversity. And so it's not really something that you've necessarily experienced. And if you go outside of your town, you yourself are not going to experience racism because you're a Caucasian male and you fortunate, even though you're gay, I assume you're gay, right?
Yeah.
I know, I'm just kidding.
But,
I know.
I'm
just joking. No, but it's because you're gay. I mean, even though you're gay, you're a white Caucasian male. And so you really have it really good in this world because you are at the apex of it, besides the fact you're gay, I mean, in terms of racism or discrimination outside of the gay thing, I mean. So if you, so you see what I'm saying? In terms of racism, you don't understand it, or you may, it's not that you don't understand necessarily, but you don't experience it. So you can't really necessarily see it because you don't know what it's like to be discriminated against.
Exactly. So, but yeah. I think that's at the basis of all of the entire conversation, is that perception is reality.
Mm-hmm.
It's what you come from. It's the perspective that you have of your genetic makeup and your racial background. So to me, there is little to no racial equality because that is my reality. You know,
there is little or no racial equality or inequality.
Inequality. Yeah. Like, I live in a really great zip code, and most of my neighbors are Indian.
Mm-hmm.
And I find that they don't actively go forward in building relationships. So I tend to go out of my way to cultivate these relationships. Like, I'm always waving. In the last 2 years that they've begun to wave back at me. And then we have, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But also here we have, people are obsessed with basketball, and nearly every player on our college basketball team mm-hmm. is African American.
Mm-hmm.
So they're treated, people who are African American are treated somewhat like celebrities here because we see them more often and we cheer for them more often. And we just always equate them with Oprah, Obama, mm-hmm. and basketball.
One of the things I was saying at the beginning of the show, I understand what you're saying, but that is also, in terms of society as a whole, can be a bad thing. Because if all people see black people, for example, as are athletes or entertainers, whether they're wealthy or not, or as thugs on the other end of the spectrum, and they never really see them in the middle, just regular, normal people, everyday people, it still kind of creates a separation because then people can't really identify with them because they can't identify with somebody who's a bazillionaire, entertainer or basketball player, and they can't identify with somebody who's a criminal who's selling drugs on the streets. So what I'm trying to say is I understand what you're saying, but I think it's more important that the everyday average person lives next door to you that is black or Indian, like you said, or Hispanic or whatever, so people can really get to know them and understand them, that they are really the same. Do you see my point or not?
Yeah, I totally see the point that you're making. But for me, I never even started that way. Like, for me growing up, and I'm from a really, really small place. I'm from a place called Hippo Holler, for crying out loud. Like, they don't have paved roads. We ran barefoot and had pet roosters and picked berries and, you know, played. You know what I mean? But mm-hmm. it was never a moment where I ever thought, I never looked at someone and thought, well, what an N-word, you know, or right. what a thug, or this, that, or the other. I've never been that way, and none of my friends are that way. And I have a multitude of people who are mixed race
mm-hmm.
and a multitude of friends who are Caucasian who have married or have children with African Americans, mm-hmm. Hispanics, and other. We're all like, it has to be over because you're married to a black man, you have four kids by a Hispanic gentleman, and, you know, I go and I pray in a room full of Asians once a month. You know what I mean? Like, I don't see that, and they don't see that. And so, for me, racial inequality doesn't really...
Yeah, but the problem is that you're looking at it from a strictly social standpoint, and your society that you're around, the society you're in, apparently... is quite well evolved to some degree about race, to some degree in terms of integration, in terms of the social aspect of it. But when it comes to jobs, employment, when it comes to going outside of your town, possibly when it comes to being recognized in terms of the justice system, if these same people who are, say, for example, black, and they were your friends and your neighbors, whatever, right? Yet they were arrested. Yeah. They were arrested. Let's say your neighbor who's Caucasian, a male, was arrested, and the guy next to him who's black is arrested the same day. They may be best friends and get along great socially or whatever. But when they go to court, and this is just generally speaking, they probably are not going to be treated in the same light. I'm not saying everywhere. I'm not saying everybody's racist and not everybody is treats right. Everybody poorly. Obviously, no. But I'm saying generally, and as I've read all of these statistics to you earlier in the show, it's proven that there is a bias, a racial bias in the justice system, for example. So just because you socially are all fine with it, when it comes down to the justice system or employment, even whether it's in your community or outside of it, these things still exist outside of your community, whether you know it or not.
Even inside of my community, when put a different spin on in the four points of criteria you're using in the judicial system. Mm-hmm. I was treated unfairly because I was white.
Mm-hmm.
Like every black person I had to go to court, and every African-American person in front of me in this court proceeding had a lawyer appointed to them at no cost, and they demanded that I paid for my attorney.
Why?
And it was like, why is that? When six or seven African-Americans went ahead of me, four or five different Hispanics went ahead of me, they all get free representation, but I do not.
Why did you have to pay?
That's my point.
But I mean, why didn't you stand up? I mean, why didn't you say something? You did say something. What did they say?
Oh, yeah. Well, it was you can afford it. You can't afford it.
You don't have to. It doesn't matter. You can be appointed a court. That's their fucking constitutional right. You can be appointed somebody.
But you see my perspective is like, that doesn't make sense to me.
Well, then again, though, Ken, you know, I'm thinking about Miranda rights. And in the Miranda right, when they book someone, they tell you, they say, if you cannot afford an attorney, one will be appointed to you. So I don't know what their criteria is for saying you can or cannot afford an attorney. I guess if you make above a certain level of income, then that means you can afford it. But I think that's ridiculous, because just because you make, like, somebody can make, you know, $100,000 a year and still be broke. So, you know.
Well, yeah. But for me, even when I went to driving school and things like that as, you know, part of my punishment for my drinking and driving, which I no longer do, by the way. I don't even drink anymore, BTW, don't even drink. But when I went, the majority of people in that room were Caucasian. There were maybe two African Americans, and one of them made it a point to treat me unfairly because I was white.
Okay, Ken, you live in some alternate universe then. I just don't understand where you live.
No, that's why when you said that you were doing this show, I was like, I have to listen to it, because I have, that to me does not even exist. That to me is, it's a really small place.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
how many people would you say are in your town?
Maybe 2,400.
Oh, well, hello.
But that's my point. You would think that it being further south, and you would think that it being somewhat you would think that they would be less evolved. But that even then isn't the case.
Yeah.
And most of the drug dealers there are all white. So for me,
that's actually quite typical in small communities like my mom's, where she's from. I go back there occasionally, and I know a lot of people there. The drug dealers are almost always white. I don't know why that is, but I think it's because usually, except in your town, obviously, generally in a small town that size, the majority of the population is Caucasian, not black or Hispanic or whatever. And so typically you're going to have most likely white people selling drugs and not black otherwise. Whereas in the city, I don't know the answer. I'm just kind of pontificating.
Yeah. Well, I have like different questions for you because of your perspective. And one of them is, do you, seeing as that is my perspective and therefore my reality, do you think that I live in a post-racial society and that you do not? Or
I think that what you're experiencing is a function of where you live specifically, and so your society that you live in. If what you're telling me is exactly true, and I'm not saying you're lying, I'm just saying if everything you're saying is like exactly the way you're painting the picture for me, then yeah, I mean, I think you live in a pretty good place in terms of race. And where I live in terms of Dallas, Texas, which is a big city, right, we do not live in a post-racial society at all. And I think the majority of America is not living in a post-racial or racist society, I should say. I think you're, as I'm saying to you, is that where you
racial equality.
I think that people, in order to bring about racial equality, need to, one, educate themselves. I think a lot of people live in a bubble, and you could even say you live in a bubble, actually.
I guess I do.
You know, yeah. And people live in a bubble a lot of the times, and they stay in their own communities, and they don't really go outside of them because they just don't have a reason to or need to or whatever, or they're just comfortable there, whatever. But I think when you do that, and you said you've traveled the world, so it's not, you're not one of the people I'm referring to here, but I think a lot of people just stay their entire lives in one place and never leave and don't really get to see all kinds of people, all kinds of cultures, expose themselves to other kinds of people. And I think that's one of the main things people can do is to really expose themselves to other people that are different than they are, different than they've known in their history. And, also, secondly, allow themselves to think for themselves. I think people are often brainwashed by their family, their friends, their communities to think a certain way, and they just follow along with a groupthink instead of actually making a decision for themselves about people. That's the second thing. And the last thing, I think, is to not look at people, just basically not look at people as a race. Look at people as a human being first. And they're just like you. They have the same dreams, hopes, wishes, you know, fears, generally speaking, that you do. And, you know, you being existential you, not you, you. But anyway, and so I think that if people remember those things and they try those things, I think those are ways you can eliminate racism. Because basically the main reason people are racist is because of ignorance and not understanding someone else's true perspective from their viewpoint, as you were saying earlier, but also not exposing themselves to people different than they are. So I think that's the main thing people can do, and hopefully that will work. But the problem is people are complacent and lazy, and they don't want to try, and they don't want to rock the boat of their lives. There was one thing I saw the other day where a lady said she was a girl in Dallas, Texas, actually, and she has a cousin who is biracial, and half black, half white. And when he would come over when they were teenagers to play and stuff like that, she loved him to death, very close to him, whatever. But her friends were like looking at him all weird and acting all strange.
Be judged by not the color of the skin, but by the content of their character.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's closer to reality now than it ever has been. Yeah, it's not completely that way, but I think that we're heading in the right. Well, I was thinking that, you know, that we are closer to having racial equality now more than right. We ever have been. You know, I think that we're heading in the right direction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think, and to go to the point of, you know, employment, like the man who has the most important job in the country is not Caucasian, and the richest woman in the world is African American. And, you know, I think that we're farther along now than we have ever been, and I think that I'm not quite sure, aside from people going outside of their comfort zones, like you suggested, how else it could possibly bring about racial equality or, you know, just the regular discriminations of all.
It's just education. It's education and lack of ignorance, like I was saying. It's basically that. So I want to thank Ken Boggle for calling in. He's getting a free T-shirt because he said the magic word. I want to thank David for chiming in the chat room, and everybody else, have a good night. Thanks for listening to the show, and I'll be back later in the week. Thank you, everybody. Good night. Fellas good. You know what fellas good for the moolah. You know what fellas good for the moolah. We'll be right back.
what's good for the moolah.
The hardest part was figuring out where to go. I didn't want to explain military life before talking about what I needed. Safeguard Veterans connected me to people and resources that understood military life. That made taking the next step easier.
You served others. Let your community support you. Visit safeguardveterans.net and click on your city. Safeguard Veterans. Any door, the right support.